Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage.
Hello, friends, and thanks for joining us once again for the Saturday Frights podcast. This week, the projectionist and I will be discussing 1985's cult classic, Return of the Living Dead. This is a pretty big film to tackle, projectionist. Personally, it ranks up there with Phantasm, Reanimator, and Phantom of the Paradise in my book.
Indeed. I dare say that it might stand shoulder to shoulder with George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead. And that is even with the film focusing on a bunch of young punks that earn a much-needed lesson on respect. A fatal lesson.
Bold words. And I mostly agree with you, but we'll get to all that after the synopsis.
Place your bets, dear listeners, on if Victor will stick to his new and improved synopsis, or revert to his half an hour version.
Take the high road, Vic. Take the high road. Of course, since we are going to be discussing Return of the Living Dead, I will be delving into some spoiler territory with this synopsis, so consider yourself warned. As the movie begins, we are introduced to three of our main protagonists. Frank, played by poltergeist James Caron, his nephew Freddy, portrayed by Tom Matthews, and their boss at the Unita Medical Supply Warehouse, named Burt Wilson, played by the legendary Clue Gulager. It is Freddy's first day on the job, and Uncle Frank is showing the young man what his duties will be around the warehouse, pointing out the various items that they ship out across the country. Everything from bedpans to half dogs for dissection studies. And the freezer room for cadavers, of course. We are next introduced to Freddy's girlfriend, Tina, and her motley collection of punk rocker friends, who are trying to decide best on how to spend their evening. We have Spider, who is played by Friday the 13th, A New Beginnings, Miguel A. Nunez. Scuzz, Chuck, who is played by Children of the Corn's John Philbin, Suicide, Casey, portrayed by the beautiful Jewel Shepherd, and last but certainly not least, we have then future Scream Queen Leanna Quigley as Trash. These kids are young and want to party, and judging by most of their names, maybe just a tad dangerous too. It's decided that Freddy always knows where the best parties are, so the group decides to go pick him up after he's done at the warehouse. Back at Unita, Freddy and Frank are in the office, and the younger man asks Frank what is absolutely hands down the weirdest thing he has seen while on the job, which turns out to be something pretty weird. Frank explains that the movie Night of the Living Dead was based on a real incident. He clarifies that the director of the film was threatened with a lawsuit if he told the truth of what occurred, which is that the government was experimenting with a chemical called Trioxin 245, something cooked up by the Daryl Chemical Company for the U.S. Army to spray on marijuana crops. Except, due to a chemical spill, the stuff soaked into the ground and had the unforeseen side effect of causing corpses to appear as if they were reanimated. So the U.S. Army got the situation under control, locking the corpses in airtight steel containers, and had intended to ship them back to the Daryl Chemical Company. Except, due to an error, the Unita Medical Warehouse received them instead, and has stored them down in the basement for the last 16 years. The older man can tell that Freddy is pretty excited to be let in on this little secret, and shows him the containers down in the basement. The young man questions how airtight they are as he stares down into it at the shriveled corpse within, as Frank bangs on the side of it to prove they are solid, which causes a leak of the toxic green trioxin vapor to erupt from the container, right in the faces of both Frank and Freddy, who immediately start to gag and retch before passing out on the basement floor, as that gas rises up through the entire warehouse. Meanwhile, Tina and the gang arrive at the warehouse, but have to kill time before Freddy gets off work. Thankfully for them, there happens to be a graveyard right next door, a secluded spot for them to drink, listen to their loud music, and for Trash to discuss her worst fear, which is dead old men rising from the grave to surround her and then eat her alive. Back in the warehouse, Frank and Freddy wake up and have good reason to be worried. They are both sick to their stomach and look very pale. And just where did the corpse go that was in the container? The duo assume it must have disintegrated when it hit the air and head back upstairs, where they find things are even worse. Everything that the trioxin touched that was once alive has been reanimated. The half-dogs, the pinned butterflies, and a very angry-sounding cadaver in the freezer room. Frank decides to call in Bert, who, while furious at the two for messing with the containers in the first place, is a man who keeps his eye on the prize. The first thing they must do is get rid of that reanimated cadaver. Bert arms himself with a pickaxe, and when the cadaver is freed, he plants it firmly in the raging corpse's skull, pinning it to the ground, where it kicks and screams as the trio quickly learn that Night of the Living Dead's rules of going for the brain is false. Bert has another plan, which is to hack up the body and put the steel squirming parts in trash bags and head over to the nearby mortuary where they can have all the things incinerated. The problem with that is they are going to have to come up with a decent lie to spin to Ernie Kaltenbrunner, the mortician, to use that crematorium. As the trio are trying to do just that, Trash has decided to liven things up by dancing and stripping down to her birthday suit on top of a tomb. While her friends encourage this, Tina decides to excuse herself and heads over to the warehouse to hang out with Freddy. Seeing everything in disarray from the cadaver's attack earlier, the young girl naturally gets worried. Searching for her boyfriend, she wanders down into the basement, where she is confronted by the inhabitant of that ruptured container, the Tar Man, a skeletal-like zombie that's flesh has mixed with the trioxin and is oozing off as it shambles quickly forward to attack the young girl. Tina locks herself inside a metal closet, and yet again we are shown that these zombies aren't like Romero's, as the Tar Man finds a chain and begins to operate a winch to rip the doors off. While this is going on, Bert has been able to convince his friend Ernie to cremate the bags full of the incriminating reanimated things from the warehouse. And I swear that, Bert and Ernie, that has to be a Sesame Street joke. Things aren't going so well for Frank and Freddy, though, as they continue to get sicker and sicker. Bert thinks he's home free, except we viewers can see the smoke and ash from the crematorium, where it seeds the clouds overhead, resulting in a thunderstorm which releases a torrential downpour. Tina's friends in the cemetery are forced to make a run from the stinging, trioxin-laced rain to the safety of Suicide's beat-up car, which has a ripped-up top. And then the kids are beating feet again to avoid the rain to the warehouse, where they arrive in time to hear Tina's screams for help from down in the basement. The group rushes to her aid and arrive just as the closet doors are ripped off by the winch, and they also come face to face with the Tar Man, who happily announces, "More brains." Before anyone can react, the zombie grabs Suicide and pulls him forward as it takes a huge bloody chunk out of his forehead. As you might imagine, this causes the teenagers to flee from the warehouse in terror, leaving poor Suicide to twitch in a pool of his own blood as a hungry Tar Man gets to work. As the teenagers flee the warehouse, Casey is pretty sure she saw Freddy entering the mortuary earlier. You know, when he and his uncle, along with Bert, were trying to dispose of the undead evidence. The kids decide to make a break for the mortuary, cutting through the cemetery, except all of that rain mixed with the trioxin. Yep. You've already guessed it, has soaked into the grave dirt and deep into the soil, causing the undead to crawl their way out of their now not-so-final resting places, and they are quite ravenous for the taste of brains. The group is splintered, with Spider, Tina, and Scuzz rushing through the hordes of emerging undead to the mortuary, with Chuck and Casey deciding it's safer back at the warehouse, leaving poor Trash all alone. But not for long, as she is surrounded by a group of old men, just like her fears, and they drag her down to eat her alive. That's where I'll stop with the synopsis, friends, with our group of heroes besieged by the return of the living dead.
Almost 8 minutes for your synopsis, Victor. A rather boring 480 seconds, to be absolutely honest.
Thanks. I was thinking that before we talk about some of the more interesting background info, in trivia, we should share our personal experiences with Return of the Living Dead, projectionist.
Certainly. This was in fact shown at the Haunted Drive-In when it was originally released on August 16, 1985. It performed wonderfully, though it took a week or so of word of mouth to really bring in the audiences. Mostly college kids, eager to revel in the gore, snuggling up to their dear ones as the zombie carnage unspooled upon the screen. How about yourself, Sage?
This is one of those films that my father and I caught at the 62 drive-in. I remember it being incredibly packed, and the audience was really into all of the wickedly humorous moments, because when you get down to it, Return of the Living Dead certainly has some scares, but it is very much a black comedy. I do recall something very odd, though, that occurred in its second week at the 62. The second movie presented was 1984's Terminator, which had just been released on VHS at the time, like a week earlier. So I'm not sure why the drive-in decided to pair it up with Return of the Living Dead. Maybe Terminator had a limited re-release or something.
Not that I recall, Victor.
Well, whatever the reason for it, I thought it made a very good pairing. You know, the zombie apocalypse to start the evening off right, followed then by the desperate attempt to fend off a future robotic apocalypse. The film also, or I should say the music used in the movie, made me realize I was a closet punk.
I believe our dear listeners would like to know about the connections between this film and George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead.
I was just about to bring that up, projectionist. John Russo co-wrote the original Night of the Living Dead screenplay with Romero back in 1968, but parted ways after that first film. Although, John retained the rights to the Living Dead title to be used in future films, while Romero could make his own sequels, which of course he did, in 1978 with Dawn of the Dead, and then finishing up the trilogy in 1985 with Day of the Dead, a mere month before Return of the Living Dead. Russo wrote a novel entitled Night of the Living Dead back in 1978, an actual sequel to the first film that took place 10 years after the original. I actually own it. It was the first book I ever bought at our local Barnes & Noble.
A very fascinating fact, Sage. John Russo, since 1978, had been attempting to get a film made from his novel. And when it was picked up, the original producer's intent was to have Tobe Hooper, of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre fame, direct the feature. Also, at that time, Dan O'Bannon was brought in as a script doctor.
That is the same Dan O'Bannon that wrote the screenplay for 1979's Alien, 1981's Dead and Buried, and 1985's Life Force.
How ironic that Tobe Hooper would leave the project to direct Life Force, which is how Dan O'Bannon was asked to take over as director for Return of the Living Dead.
Though, O'Bannon had one request before agreeing to that duty, and that was he wanted to completely overhaul the script to distance it from Romero's universe. To do that, he added all of that dark humor that makes the movie stand out. Hardly anything of Russo's story remained, but ironically enough, he did write the novelization for Return of the Living Dead, which stuck to the script that O'Bannon had created, with the addition of an odd subplot involving KGB agents. Producer and frequent Romero collaborator Richard P. Rubenstein, in an effort to stop confusion between Day of the Dead and this movie, actually got an injunction to stop the film from using Living Dead in its title. However, the MPAA ruled in favor of Return of the Living Dead's producers.
As you mentioned in your, shall we call it synopsis, Victor? There are other differences between the films, such as the zombies themselves.
True. In Return of the Living Dead, they are fast, resourceful, smart even in some cases, like using a radio to call in more police to feast on. Like I mentioned earlier, they can't be killed either. I mean, you can shoot them in the head all you want, but they will just keep on coming until they crack open your skull to get at your brain. Oh, that's a huge difference right there, listeners, where Romero zombies will eat all of you. In Return of the Living Dead, they are interested in only one thing, your brains. This film was the first one to have zombies craving your brain lobes. Sorry, small spoiler, but towards the end of the film, we learn why. Ernie has a zombie strapped on his embalming table, questioning it when the monster croaks its explanation that it needs brains to halt the pain of being dead. It can feel itself rotting. So I guess you could say the zombies are using brains as a drug to temporarily halt their discomfort.
Victor, did you feel the chemical used to raise the dead in this film? The Trioxin 245 was a reference to George Romero's 1973 film, The Crazies?
In that film, the virus was called Trixie, right?
Yes.
Yeah? Trixie? Trioxin? I guess it could be a tip of the hat to Romero. Jumping back to Ernie the Mortician, who has some interesting elements of his backstory that if you aren't paying attention to, you might miss. When we first meet him, as Bert and his employees are coming over to ask that favor of disposing of evidence, he is listening to the German Africa Corps marching song on his headphones. He carries a Walther P-38, and he has a picture of Adolf Hitler's wife, Eva Braun, in the morgue. And when the zombie reveals they are hurting from the pain of being dead, it really seems to bother him. So popular fan theory is that Ernie, who is an older man, is in fact a Nazi in hiding, one that worked at a death camp. Don Coffa, who by the way played Ernie, also seems to be a fan of the film, as he tried, sadly unsuccessfully, to get a sequel to the film made in graphic novel form. It had nothing to do with the 1988 film sequel, but picked up after the end of the first movie. Another fun fact, Dan O'Bannon actually approached Jewel Shepherd to play the part of Trash, but the young woman didn't want to take on more roles that required nudity. Besides, she felt that she was a person who liked to party, so that's why she went for the role of Casey. While we were on the subject of Jewel Shepherd, did I ever tell you I met her projectionist?
Not that I recall.
Well, it's true. It was when I went to my very first San Diego Comic-Con. The one artist I wanted to meet and thank for his work was the late, great Dave Stevens, the creator and illustrator for The Rocketeer. She was sitting at the same booth with Mr. Stevens. She had just published a memoir entitled, If I'm So Famous, How Come Nobody's Heard of Me? I picked up a copy of her book and she was kind enough to sign it for me. And I did my best not to blush because I kind of had a crush on her from this film. She also was one of Dave Stevens' models.
I too have a tidbit of knowledge that our dear listeners might find of interest. Sometime in the early 1990s, there was discovered a work print for Return of the Living Dead that ended up being 24 minutes longer than the version released to theaters.
Oh, wow. Do we have a copy of that in the Retro's Vault?
It is available on your interwebs. Daniel 13 was able to locate it for me. It is very poor quality, but of interest if you find yourself a fan of the film.
I'll be sure to check that out after we finish recording this episode. Of course, when talking about Return of the Living Dead, we must definitely talk about its rockin' soundtrack. I think most people who've watched the movie remember 45 Graves, Party Time, the zombie version, that was used when the living dead are emerging from their graves. Soundtrack also boasted the likes of The Cramps, TSOL, The Flesh Eaters, The Damned, Tall Boys, Jet Black Berries, SSQ, and my personal favorite, Burn the Flames by Rocky Erickson. That certainly isn't the most punk song on the soundtrack, but it is my favorite. One of those reasons is because when they use it in the movie, it is to me an absolutely heroic moment for one of the characters. Don't worry, friends, no spoilers. Now, before we get into the more notable cast and crew, Projectionist, do you have any ads to share with the listeners?
I most certainly do.
First, he created the most frightening film ever made. Then, he took his unique vision of terror one step further. Now, George A. Romero takes us out of the night, beyond the dawn, and into the darkest day of horror the world has ever known. Day of the Dead. George A. Romero's Day of the Dead, the most eagerly awaited day in horror film history.
Dan O'Bannon sadly passed away on December 17, 2009. He was known for writing two segments of the 1981 heavy metal animated film, Soft Landing, which is really the film's title sequence, as well as the zombie World War II segment entitled B-17. He also wrote the screenplays for 1983's Blue Thunder, 1986's Invaders from Mars remake, and 1990's Total Recall. Clue Gallagher has 159 acting credits to his name, with notable roles in 1964's The Killers, 1971's The Last Picture Show, and 1987's The Offspring. James Caron has 197 acting credits, with notable roles in 1969's Hercules in New York, 1977's Capricorn 1, 1979's The China Syndrome, 1986's Invaders from Mars, 1987's Wall Street, 1988's Return of the Living Dead 2, and 2006's Superman Returns. Don Kalfa has 86 credits with appearances in 1983's The Star Chamber, 1989's Weekend at Bernie's, and 1991's Bugsy. Tom Matthew has only 35 acting credits, but notable appearances in 1986's Jason Lives, Friday the 13th Part 6, as well as 1988's sequel to Return of the Living Dead. I should add that Tom and James Caron played different characters in the sequel. Tom was also in 1991's Blood Match and 1997's Peacemaker. Linnea Quigley has 136 acting credits to her name, with notable roles in 1978's Death Sport, 1981's Graduation Day, 1984's Savage Streets with exorcist Glenda Blair. That same year, she was in Silent Night, Deadly Night. She was also in 1988's Night of the Demons, as well as A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master. Jewel Shepherd has only 25 acting credits, with appearances in 1982's Zap, 1984's Hollywood Hot Tubs, as well as its 1990 sequel. She also provided voices for two episodes of Garfield and Friends. John Philbin has earned 47 acting credits with notable roles in 1991's Point Break, 1997's Tombstone, and in that same year, he appeared in Moonbase. Last but not least is Miguel A. Nunez Jr., who has garnered 100 acting credits with notable roles in 1984's Tron-inspired TV series Automan, 1985's Friday the 13th: A New Beginning, 1988's Action Jackson, as well as 56 episodes of the popular Tour of Duty television series where he portrayed Marcus Taylor. He was also seen in 1992's Lethal Weapon 3, as well as 2002's live-action Scooby-Doo. Friends, I think that about wraps up this episode of the Saturday Frights podcast. On behalf of the Projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. If you did enjoy the show, we hope you will hop on over to The Retroist every Saturday, where we present everything from classic horror TV shows to the best in frightening shorts. The music you hear on the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. That is peachy@retroist.com. Of course, I have to give thanks for the invaluable feedback from my co-host, The Projectionist. Where can your fans find you if they wish to contact you?
By finding a deep well and visiting it when the moon is full and whispering your questions. Or you can find me on the Facebooks, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In.
If you are new to our show, we do have a Saturday Frights Facebook page as well, and we would greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you, and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. Our podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher, and we would certainly appreciate it if you could click subscribe. Maybe even leave us a nice review if you're pleased with our work. I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows or even feedback, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to The Retroist himself for not only allowing us to record here in The Retroist Vault, but hosting the podcast as well. When you have retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until next time, the vault
is sealed.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
It began in May. And every month after that, whenever the moon was full, it happened again. And again.
What was that?
It's over there.
Who winked that at me?
Nobody knew who or what was responsible.
Come on.
They only knew it had to be stopped. Now, from the master of mystery and suspense, Stephen King's Silver Bullet. Silver Bullet, the last glimmering hope.
This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye.